Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the podcast. I'm sitting here with my co-host and technical guru, Jim.
Oh, hey, guys.
Jim, and...
Whoa. OPSEC!
All right, do you want to keep it or no?
I want to keep my OPSEC. All
right.
The government's after me, man.
I told you. So, this is our first interview, and so we're proud to have a man I just met today, and who's been friends with Jim for quite a while. I had a very interesting conversation with him before we started. His name is Daniel, and he's an EMT in Cranford. We're speaking with Daniel today to hear his story on the ongoing troubling situation in Venezuela.
I know this might deviate from our normal program, but I just felt that Daniel was a subject matter expert in this field, and it would be good to learn more about the world around us and his perceptions on this. Not only that, but I think it provides a real good insight onto ourselves as a nation and also what we ought to do, what is right and morally and what is right ethically. I believe that is something that we can get out of a conversation like this. Of course, this isn't advocating any political side or advocating action of any kind. This is just three guys discussing their views on the world around them today.
Yeah, the we said in the first podcast that this show is going to be more about life and people doing extraordinary things, hence the name No Ordinary Life.
And for those of us that live in the United States, we have to keep in mind that the world is much bigger than just the United States.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we want to be learning about, we consider this an extraordinary type of thing that you want to discuss with us today. And we might have to have you on a second time in the future to talk about other things, because I see that you've had a pretty lush life. Say you told me that you left home at 14 in Venezuela, and you started out pretty much, you were a man at 14, and you started working, and you did a lot of amazing things. I was blown away by what you told me. So you have some stories to tell there, and we want to definitely see if we could
I believe a good segue into introducing Daniel is a quote that he is often fond of saying and that he has taught me. It is, what is it, Daniel?
Everything will happen to you until you decide otherwise.
That's right. Everything will happen to you until you decide otherwise. And with that, Daniel, please take it away.
Hi, guys. Okay, a little bit about me. Well, like Fred was saying, I left home at 14. I come from a very poor family, no father. And then after that, I decided to never allow the street to shape me. I only took the experiences out of it and never did drugs. I always was against the wrongdoings that were happening around me and decided to take action on every single thing needed from me at the time.
Right. I think this brings up a good point that at the end of the day, the master of your own decisions and fate is you yourself. You have all these outside interactions trying to affect your life, but you ultimately decide whether you want to cave in or follow a different path.
Right. And I see myself in a way that if I was able to do it, everybody can do it. You know, you will face temptation in your life and you will face things that will push you towards something. And it's up to you to hold your grounds, to say no, to move around things and better yourself and execute that. You will have always your demons to battle, and that's for sure something that we all have. And in a way, I feel that I never cave in into that. I find myself in a path that I have shaped and I keep shaping nowadays. I would love to learn everything that I can, get my mind around and talk to people that can teach me anything every day, even at my 43. So
now, this mindset that you just explained to us that you had when you were younger about living on the streets and staying away from the bad stuff and everything, that's a very mature mindset to have at that age. Did you actually just have that embedded in you? Or
no.
Was that coming from your parents? Was that coming from somebody in your life that was older?
Well, it definitely helped older people in my past. Was not my family. I didn't have pretty much contact with my family after I left home. So a good support system was my brothers and friends. And friends where I come from is not the type of friendship that I see here in the United States. I always said to Jim, your true friends are going to be counted with the fingers of one hand.
Yeah.
And that's something that it will resonate through different ages on your life, because it doesn't mean that it's only going to be five. It's that most of the time it's going to be just five. You will change friends. Yeah. You will leave some friends behind just because you lose contact with them, or you move out of a city or stuff like that. But in general, you're always going to have good friends. And the fact that you need to recognize that not everybody is your friend, but the ones that truly your friends, treasure them, you know, cultivate that relationship and be there for everybody. Now, giving in that part as a friend should be without expecting anything in return. And that's the best way to judge what true friends you have. So in a way, where I come from, that was embedded on me as a young person, because friends were actually there for you. And, you know, in the street, you're going to see things all the time. Bad things happen. And I was lucky enough not to be stroke back. I suffered a lot. I cannot tell you otherwise. It was through suffering that you actually get that strong. And through friends, you find yourself. And once you start having that mentality, you understand that there are people out there that is going to be in your life accidentally, and you may be a friend at that moment to them. And, you know, you just need to give the best of yourself to them at that moment, and that will shape your life.
Absolutely. That's something that I think everybody should be aspiring to. Give what you can to the people around you. Don't expect anything in return.
Right, right. And in other parts of my story is that I became very active to take control of my life since I was young. I knew very young, I was, I think, 11 when I did a kind of like a thesis of 60 pages on drugs, for example. That was the reason why it kept me out of the drug part of the streets. You know, people were doing drugs right next to me. It doesn't matter to me. And my problem with the mentality is that I was suffering so much and passing through a lot. And then they were this type of personalities out there that they were suffering, but much less, to my opinion. And they were just diving into that world. And I was like, why? I mean, I couldn't understand that part. And that makes me all the time reject the bad part of it, of the street, let's say. I focused myself into study since I was very young. I ate books. That was pretty much what I was doing. But I can tell nowadays, people are book smart or street smart. Mm. I got both.
Yeah.
And in a way, invaluable. I taught myself to do both. I was very, very straight A all the time until I was leaving my house. And then the last couple of years, I was struggling when I decided to graduate as a high school without going to have any bad grades. So the last year, I put all my focus on it, and I learned at that time I needed to just focus. And when I focus my mind into something, I put it together and I do it. Immediately after, I went to paramedic school, and after that graduation, I did my aeronautical mechanics school. I did 2 years and 2 years. At the same time, I was working in a hospital environment. The deal with them was very, very nice, because you were able to live in a hospital, and all your life is taken care in terms of food, in terms of laundry, whatnot. And then you just go downstairs and work in the ER. So that type of setting was very rewarding, because I was fulfilling my life, but I was not having a life. So after that, I decided to go to aeronautical mechanic, graduated, and then I went to work 1 year as an aeronautical mechanic for a private company. After that, I went to the capital of the country and started working in a warehouse just because of fun. I was having some vacation time and decided to just find a job. 13 years later, I was the purchasing manager of a company, of a corporation that allowed me to travel the world. And I also, in the meantime, during those years, I have my bachelor in marketing. So I switched career 3 times.
How old were you by this point?
I was 22 years old.
Meanwhile, we got 20-year-olds in college having a midlife crisis about
Yeah.
Oh my God, I'm taking 6 classes. That's too many.
Yeah.
And then, we got Daniel balancing 3 careers by the time he's 20.
And he's living on 20. His own and learning about the world.
And it was interesting to me because I remember one conversation I had with a warehouse manager where after years, he saw me with some kind of envy approach and thought that I was privileged because I must have been coming from a house of money because how come you just started less than a year ago in a warehouse assistant position and now you are invoice clerk. And then after that, I was manager, purchasing manager. How come that happened?
Yeah.
It's because I was privileged. And I said to him, look, I don't know what you're talking about, but I come from the streets. And he dared to challenge me on that. He said, you didn't come from the street. I was like, are you kidding me? I literally sleep on a bench for a week. Are you kidding me? I ate fruits in order to be able to eat. I drink water from a hose.
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You don't say that kind of thing to me.
From the outside looking in, especially from an envy standpoint, hard work and everything that you put into it does look like privilege.
Right.
But people fail to see everything you've done to get to the point you are now.
Yeah, right. You know, that's an annoying thing that people do that I've encountered before, where you have someone of some type of success at whatever level. Somebody will say, oh, it must be nice. Must be nice to have this or have that.
Right.
You know what? That person worked for that. They had to work really hard. They might be still working very hard for it. You don't know about how hard they had to buckle down, how much sacrifice they had to go into it. Yeah, it must be nice. Try working. Try getting to that level. Try educating yourself. Try pushing yourself. And maybe you can have what's nice too. Instead of
hearing Daniel's story, it's a great example of that. Not only that, but going to my family, when my parents came to this country, they were $30,000 in debt, barely spoke a lick of English, had zero connections.
Mm-hmm.
But in 16 years, just by working hard, they eventually got their own business. And now today, they're very successful. They have they own 2 homes, and they raise 2 kids in a pretty much middle-class setting, even though they came from basically nothing, even less than nothing, because, like I said, they were in debt and had zero connections. But people will claim that, you know, it was privilege, which is astounding.
It must be nice to have 2 homes.
Yeah. Despite the fact that, you know, they worked 12 hours a day, 365 days a year, pretty much, for 16 years straight.
Right.
That was the privilege right there.
Yeah, right.
Well, the point is that you need to work hard. And work hard for means different for people, you know. At the age of 20 years, I was working 18 hours a day. And I was studying 6 hours a day. Out of those 18, I was working and studying. And if you think about it, when I reached 24, I already had my bachelor. I already was like accomplished in a career. It was my 3rd degree, but I was still working 18 hours a week, a day. But my point is that you do not stop yourself just because you have accomplished something.
Yeah, never rest on your laurels.
You don't need to. I mean, it will get to a point that you will feel peace and accomplish and whatnot, but set another goal. Keep going. Your life will go around so many times that you don't know where you're going to end up.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And by the way, after that, I was so tired of making other people money that I decided to own my own company. And I resigned. I stayed for a year after I resigned because they didn't want me to go. And every single time was, okay, I'll give you a bonus. I give you this. I give you that. And they kept me for a year because I was training somebody 3 months to do my job. That person needed to go. Another person came. I trained it for 3 more months. And then that person resigned because it was too much pressure. And then another person came. And my boss was like, at that point, look, I'm trying to find somebody, but you cannot go like that. So let's, you know, he was like every single time trying to negotiate with me my living of the company. So by the time that I said, okay, you know what? I'm leaving in February, the first day of February. So forget about it. No more delays. I don't care if you're not going to have another person. That's why I decided that.
This is a good lesson to anybody listening that's trying to get themselves going in the world and make a mark for themselves. is what you did with that company, or what happened there, was you became invaluable to them.
Right.
You were invaluable. So you have to make yourself invaluable, whatever it is you do. Specialize in something that nobody else is doing. Do the hard work that nobody else wants to do.
Right.
And become indispensable, so that no matter what, you can dictate where you're going in life. And you now have control of your own freedom, too.
Right. And at that time, I said to myself, you know what? I need to let go. Because it was my internal voice telling me, you wanted to go from the big door. You don't want to just leave and leave them, you know, merciless. Because I had so many controls on every single aspect of the operations that it didn't feel right to me. So I decided to stay, trying to find somebody to replace me. And by the time that I left, I was training a last person for a couple of months, and he was ready. So I left. Next day, immediately, I already had my company, but next day was my first invoice that I built. So from that moment on, I skyrocketed so much. I made money so much that in 3 years, I was able to decide, I'm going to go and live to the United States with my family. And I put all my savings and came here with two suitcases, each one of us. And you're not going to believe it, $20,000 in the bank. That was it.
Mm.
And I decided to come to the United States.
Did that feel like...
I never had savings in my life.
Right. Was that a large money amount?
No.
No, okay. Your perception was, yeah.
My perception was...
I didn't have enough.
Yeah. I didn't have enough. Yeah. But, and if you think about it, the minimum salary is about $30,000 a year.
Yeah.
So I came to the United States with less than a whole savings of a year. I couldn't even live with just that. So by the time that I come here, I don't have anything. I don't have family. I don't have a structure. And I start working just because I put my mind on it. I was visiting some bakeries and offering my technological skills. I was offering to repair computers and so on. I started baking. My wife is a great a cooker.
His wife is also pretty incredible. She's got careers too.
Yeah, I was learning that, yes.
So we started baking for a living and doing that computer repair type of jobs. Plus, I was delivering newspapers.
Wow.
At 3 in the morning.
Yeah.
So for me, hard work is like nothing. I was like born doing hard work. So when people said to me, you got to be here at 3 in the morning and your shift finished pretty much at 7, I was like, no problem. And at 7, I was going back home, cooking some empanadas and food for a restaurant that was buying it from us in town. And they were at 7:30 coming because my wife wake up at 6 doing part of the cooking. So I helped her at 7 and 7:30 we were delivering all the food. And at 8 I was hitting the bakeries offering my computer skills. So one day I one person bring me to another. And I met this guy who was kind enough. I'm never going to forget that guy. So I went in and fixed his computer. He got a huge issue at home. He was a big company owner. And I fixed his computer. And I used to rate my skill at $100 per computer. So people will come and oh my God, $100 and you fix it here. Well, this guy, I spent 6 hours at his home, and he said, I'm not going to give you $100. You need to tell me how much per hour you, any good technician charges, and I'll pay you
absolutely,
that.
Absolutely, yeah, right.
And I was like, no, I charge you $100. That's why we deal for it. But you stay 6 hours. 6 hours of your time doesn't cost $100. And I said, you know what? Okay, technicians usually charge $120 per hour. If you want, we can go half of it. He didn't hesitate. He wrote me a check for the $600. And that I would never forget.
Wow.
That was amazing. Very, very nice of him. And that's integrity. That's what I keep trying to tell everybody about integrity, about honesty, about following the pattern of a life that really will put you out there and get you places. You know, if you look inside of yourself, you're going to be able to hold your head high at any given time. So that's the point. And it's just about hard work. It's just about education. It's just about how you conduct your life. So
Sorry about the siren, by the way.
That's my life, pretty much. And then I had 40 credits in Union County College towards my degree.
Firefighters are so inconsiderate.
I finished. Yeah, right?
You're a firefighter, man. You're trying to do a podcast, and they're just driving around.
Yeah, and study hard, work hard, meet people that stay with people that are going to be interesting to you, that have something to offer in their friendship, that is not just wasting time and talking nonsense.
Yeah.
Just wanted to backtrack real quick to what you were saying about getting up at 3 in the morning and then working till 7 at night. That didn't seem like hard work to you, but to, I'm sure, many people out there, there's like, well, that's crazy. How could you possibly do that? But we have to keep in mind that as we live a certain lifestyle, we get used to it. And what used to seem difficult before is now much easier. Just like when you first start lifting weights, trying to reach 135 pounds on bench press might seem like an impossible task. But after, you know, consistently hitting the gym, eventually it becomes cake. And you're like, well, that's easy. Now I'm going to go shoot for 315 pounds instead. And that seems daunting, but... You know, keep working at it, and eventually you'll get there.
That's one of the lessons of working out, of weightlifting in general, is that it's like
Don't be discouraged if you can't do something initially.
You're always failing. You're always failing when you're working. Right. You fail every time you go to work out because you want to reach this goal, but your goal is always moving. It's always going up, and you're always failing. So life is the same thing.
It's the same thing.
You should always be failing, but learning from the experience.
Right. And if I look back into my life, I always have started from scratch in a certain point in my life, from zero. And that is what it make me resilient to a point that I don't mind if that brings me to the story of the squad, for example. I was working...
Oh, we didn't mention the squad, I think.
Right.
The squad meaning the first aid squad?
First aid squad, yeah. So
that's how I met Daniel, by the way. We both volunteered at this first aid squad together, and where he currently volunteers and is the treasurer, right? Treasurer, yeah.
Correct. So I started working finally after I got my papers 1 year after I arrived, 9 to 5, in an advertising company as a director of marketing, back to my career. So I started making money, and working 9 to 5 Monday to Friday doesn't cut to me. So in less than a year, I was bored. I was like, I need to...
Bored because you weren't working more. You weren't filling up hours more.
Exactly. I was like... Okay, I have my kids, I have everything under control, I have my life going, my economy is doing great, all that kind of thing happened, now what?
Yeah, your mind and body is so used to operating at this high level now that you
were like a race car that goes 100 miles an hour all the time. Now they're asking you to go 25 miles an hour. And it just doesn't work. My car is not designed.
But it's funny, though, because now you've adapted to this lifestyle, right? And, like, stresses in this life, like, affect you more than maybe it would have in the past.
Yes. And for example, now I see myself in a situation where, okay, I need to do more. And I always helped everybody. And this is embedded in my mind since my childhood. And I said to myself, the only way that I can... possibly enjoys doing something is going back to medicine. I started finding out about first aid squad. I apply. I was called, and in less than a month, I started volunteer here. And when I start having conversation with everybody here about all my 4 years of paramedic and going to air crashes and picking up bodies and having thousands of car crashes and ER environment, everybody was like stunned. They don't have the experience that I have. So all of them combined would not have the experience that I have only in medicine. And that was 20 years ago now.
Man.
So I'm like, okay, I can help. You know, I just need to get my certifications online back on. And
this is funny because it goes back to our first podcast where we were discussing what qualifies you as an expert in something, a certification or, you know, years of experience constantly applying yourself to this profession, which Daniel has. But it's kind of silly because by legal mandate, you can't operate as a EMT without the certification, even though he's had more experience just coming onto the field than pretty much everybody in the squad combined at that point.
And I went for my EMT. I did it like in a blink of an eye. It didn't took any effort from me, let's say. By the following year, Hurricane Irene hit the squad and the whole building got destroyed.
Yeah, it was like basically half half the building was underwater, right?
6 foot of water. Outside.
Yeah.
Six foot of water.
Basically, this building was in the river.
Correct. So the river passed through the whole building, and thank God we saved the equipment, part of the equipment and the boat rigs. And at that time, it amazed me that 24 members, about 18 resigned, decided to think, this is done. That's it. There is no more squad. Hmm. A week after, we met in the driveway, and everything is destroyed, and six of us, where like I wasn't even an officer, and six of us was looking at each other, and they were like very down, you know, feeling depressed and everything else. And I was like, I don't know what you guys are talking. This is nothing. This is just walls. You put the walls back, and that's it. You have your house.
Yeah.
We have equipment. We can function. That's not a problem. So I feel that I start pushing people around so much to a point that was in August 2011. And by December, they were saying, Danny, you need to be a captain. And I was like, are you kidding me? So in less than a month, in September, I pushed the captain at the time so much to just function from trailers outside the building. So we had money, thank God, in the organization. And we rented a trailer. And we started functioning in the middle of the winter from trailers. And it was amazing because my point was like, if you are not functioning from the building, you lose the opportunity to come every single minute you have to clean up, to demolish, to do things at the building.
Right, right. That's a good point.
So we were functioning before for a month from another organization across town. So that's not going to work for us to recover so fast. So to give you an example and make the story shorter, we reconstruct the building in 6 months. By February, the whole building was new. Not only because of our effort, but of course the community came and poured help. They bring money, they bring equipment, they bring construction supplies, they gave free construction workers time, and so on. But it was because we were here all the time. And I remember one key person that showed up one day, he was 60 years old. He said, how can I help? And I said, just tell us what you can help, and we will direct it in a certain way. He was an accountant, but he was retired, and he knew everybody in town. And that was enough. He connected us with so many people at the same time. In less than a month, we were having here retired construction people, retired architects, retired engineers, everybody.
That's amazing.
And in comparison, the police department also got destroyed during the hurricane building, and right, they took 2 years to reconstruct. So that's why my life with the squad became now an essential part of my life, because I rebuilt it from the ashes. And every single aspect of the operation was intuitive to me because of what I left 20 years ago. So there is a lot of experience involved because of getting involved so much at so young age, and doing things that most likely people at that age will not have been doing. Get out there. Start doing things.
I forgot who told me this, but they said that the strongest force in this world is the human spirit. And as long as you don't allow the world to take over you, anything can be possible. And Daniel here is a testament to that.
Yeah, in fact, what I'm getting a sense, what I hear through what you're saying is you're a type of person that when you wake up, you feel, you know that you could change the world.
Yeah, I do it every day.
You know it.
I know.
Yeah.
You can change one the of the things that I said to all the new people who start in the squad is that we save lives here. Look, you may not feel like you're saving a life, but you're saving life in a different ways. When you go into a house where people are at their worst time ever, just the fact that somebody shows up in a uniform, it doesn't matter if you have level of expertise on your belt. It doesn't matter if you are educated. We have ride-alongs. We have cadets in our programs, and they are part of the same group that go into an emergency call. is the effect that you cause on a person that finally help is here. And I'm going to tell you how you can measure it. When you were little, some point, at some time, you were feeling bad because you were sick, because you were having a fever or something like that. The moment that you may have, all of us have that type of memory when we were younger. The moment that your mom shows up or your father show up or somebody that shows up and you had conscious at the moment that help was there, is the same feeling, instinctive feeling that any person will have and produce at the moment that we show up at their doors. So in a way, I say save lives because it's that desperate moment of a person that forced them to call 911. Do you think that people would like to call 911? No, especially old people. They don't want to bother anybody.
Right.
You know, yeah. They feel yeah. that, you know, I don't want to bother you guys, you know, you busy yeah. or whatever. No, we're here for you. But they feel it that way. But it's because we show up that they feel that sensation. And that is saving life because their mindset changed.
Absolutely. Right.
And if you show compassion to them, if you show that, look, this is because we treat you like family, then it's a more rewarding experience for them. And especially because you do it for free, then you win them right there.
Yeah, right.
That's so overwhelming to them. I have people, veterans and all kind of people saying to me, this is crazy. You're doing this for free? Well, it's as rewarding for you that it's rewarding to me. You know, that's my point.
Something you can't really buy is human gratitude. And that is something that it's great to have. Can't.
Correct.
Yeah, there's nowhere that you can purchase that. And just it becomes a more valuable resource because of that. And it takes an action such as volunteering to get something like that.
Yes. And that reminds me one call I have with one person. He was a very disturbed veteran. He lost his house. He was an alcoholic. He was in a really bad shape. He used to be a frequent flyer here in terms of the... The description is because we had him all the time. He always cursed at us. Fuck you, fuck you. You don't know anything. He went to NAM and everything else. He was like destroyed psychologically to a point that the whole system was working against him.
To be fair, that was kind of part of our training in the military.
Right.
Injecting the curse words into every other letter.
Well, but in a way, his argument was, fuck you, I serve my country.
Right.
So for every single command that the police tell him to do or us in terms of, please put your feet on the sit down in the stretcher seat, you know, let me put your buckle on, whatever. It was always in his mind, being drunk, saying, fuck you, I serve my country. Fuck you, I serve my country. I deserve to do whatever I want. One day, I have him several times. One day, I decided to confront him with that idea. And I said to him, you know what? You serve your country. That's true. And I say thank you to you for that. But I'm serving my country right now, and I'm not getting paid. You got paid. So at that point, he was like, what?
You just dropped knowledge, right?
He was like, what? This is crazy, he said to me. This is crazy. How can you... Something is wrong. Mm. Somebody is paying for this. This is not happening the way that you're saying it. No, it is. It is real. It is for free.
I think this goes back to not resting on your laurels. Don't live your entire life based off of your past accomplishments. Every day you should seek to accomplish something new and something better.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't just live your past, yeah. Even if it was good stuff. I mean, obviously, you take that stuff with you.
Your past accomplishments is money in the bank, but that money runs out, so you have to constantly feed the bank, I guess, is
right.
The analogy here.
I can't believe somebody doesn't understand the whole concept of a volunteer first aid squad. The word volunteer is in there. I mean, it's a little...
Well, to his point, I say, he wasn't aware that we were involved.
Yeah, oh, okay. All right, I got you.
You know,
right.
He was drunk. He just
he
saw an ambulance.
Sorts. Yeah.
You know, he saw the resources being thrown at him, and somebody's going to pay for it, probably his VA, VA and whatnot. But that's the message that I needed
to
cross.
That's to a certain extent. Because
right,
the VA only applies if you use their services, but... other agencies, yeah, I think they'd bill the VA directly if you to settle the charges. But yeah,
this reminds me of we had a job in town where we work, fire in an apartment building, and there was smoke coming out the window. There was a few individuals with a small child, and when we pulled up, it was, you know, all rush. We saw the smoke. It was a, you know, it was reported of a fire, and the guy's yelling out the window, "Hurry up, motherfuckers! Hurry up, you motherfuckers!" Like 100 times, you know, and we entered the building, we started making our way up the stairs, and meanwhile the ladder company's working outside, they're raising the aerial, you know, it only moves so fast, you know, and they're positioning it, and guy's hanging his kid out the window, you know, he's just completely panicked, and you know, we're doing everything we can to get, you know, the guys on the ladder grabbed the kid. We went inside and we grabbed the adults and we brought them down the stairwell. It turned out it wasn't even that bad of a fire to begin with. It was really nothing. It was actually out on arrival. But this guy was just cursing us up and down. And yeah, you know, it's not a volunteer fire department, but we are putting our lives on the line for these strangers. And I mean, we didn't get mad at him. I mean, people panic. They act unusual under, and who knows? Maybe he could have been drinking too or something. But it's just kind of a strange thing, right? When you're approaching somebody to help them and they're treating you like that.
Yeah, and I feel that it's ignorance, and in a way, the educational system has failed us to prepare you for any kind of situation, not only at a basic level of sense of awareness, and not, and following that, the educational system do not create empathy on people, so they don't appreciate.
No.
You know, they don't appreciate the work of anybody. You know, it feels so entitled.
Entitlement, yeah.